Welcome to the Financial Planning for Canadian Business Owners podcast. You will hear about industry insights with award-winning financial planner and entrepreneur, Jason Pereira. Through the interviews with different experts with their stories and advice, you will learn how you can navigate the challenges of being an entrepreneur, plan for success, and make the most of your business and life. And now, your host, Jason Pereira.
Today on the show, I have Richard Parker. Richard is the owner of Diomo Corporation, and I brought him on specifically to talk about his work around helping people sell businesses, and specifically his book or his entire framework on things that sellers won't tell you. So understanding what is happening or questions to ask when buying a business. And with that, here's my interview with Richard. Richard, thanks for being on.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
So Richard Parker, tell us a little bit about what it is you do.
My main role is I help people acquire businesses, and specifically in the lower market, which is defined as Main Street USA, right up to businesses that are generating around $10 million in revenue. And I work with individual buyers through education and advisory. And I do some sell side work as well, but much more so on a limited basis.
Okay, excellent. Let's talk about basically the topic of the day with you, which is essentially from an M&A standpoint, and I've done many podcasts on M&A, but the approach that we wanted to take with this one was around what you've written about, which is the things that sellers aren't going to tell you. And this is not about malice necessarily. Sometimes it's ignorance or oversight. As a buyer, the questions you're asking about this company are incredibly important because you do not have line of sight. You're basically trying to figure everything out from disclosures, conversations, whatever else it is. So knowing where to start and what to ask is basically difficult for the uninitiated. So talk to me about, let's start going through them. We don't have to go through all 10. Let's go through the big ones. What is the biggest thing that a seller's not telling you that you need to be aware of as a buyer?
There are a couple of them. Certainly, we have a top 10, but amongst those, putting into a little bit of hierarchy, is what is very typical is what does the business look like in the future? Meaning their perception. No one knows that particular business better than the seller. The goal of the buyer is to try to get close to that. And as you pointed out, there's a lot of work involved with that. But as far as a hands-on feel for what the business looks like, what the future looks like, oftentimes even it doesn't mean it's dismal just because of the fact they're selling, and the quite opposite holds true. So that shouldn't be a consideration. But when we talk about what the future looks like, is it's critically important for a buyer who is acquiring a business that, assuming all things remain status quo, they want to know that the business is going to continue in the future as it did in the most recent past. In other words, the way I like to term it is growth is very sexy, but stability provides value. And so you want to make sure that as a buyer, when you take it over, that it's going to remain stable. And so digging into what the future is going to look like to the best of the knowledge of the seller is what you really have to uncover. And that includes, for example, let's talk about a business, a non-retail business. So something that's distribution, manufacturing, et cetera, business services, where there may be some client concentration issues. The overarching theme is, are customers going to continue to buy from you? Is the seller the entire business? And so what happens in businesses where the seller, where the clients, for example, recognize or acknowledge the business being the seller themselves. Will customers continue to buy from you? Will employees remain on board? Suppliers continue to supply you? And just because you're taking over an existing business doesn't mean all of that or any of that is going to happen. And so if a seller knows that there's something, an issue related to a particular customer, are they going to disclose that? They don't have to unless you ask them. There's certain things that they have to disclose materially, legally, environmentally, et cetera. But those more granular points are not a requirement as far as disclosing materially unless you ask them. So at the top of the list is certainly for me, what does that business look like according to the seller? And what is it that he or she will or will not disclose?
Excellent. All right. So let's talk about what it is they are not going to disclose. Like, again, like I said at the beginning of this, it's not necessarily malice.
Yes, correct.
It's not even ignorance. It's just basically it's to them, it's normal, right? It's familiarity in a lot of cases. So give me some examples of things that might be familiar to the manager, to the owner, and would be material to the buyer, but the buyer wouldn't necessarily think to even bring it up.
Great question, because there's a few very clear examples. One, is what I touched on earlier, customer concentration. And you see this so frequently. You own a business, you've been running it for 15 years, you have two clients that you have a wonderful relationship, professionally, may even be personal as well. They represent a disproportionate percentage of the business, 50, 60% of the business, which is quite common in smaller businesses. And the seller doesn't lose sleep over it. None whatsoever, because they're very comfortable. That relationship is ongoing. They're fine with it. So they look at that. They don't feel it's a threat to the business. But you come in as a new buyer, or you're looking at it as a buyer, that's a massive risk. And there's ways to solve for it potentially, but that is a massive risk of something that they typically would not disclose. Similarly, on the supplier side, or the way I like to phrase it to try to get to the bottom of this with a seller is, what keeps you up at night about the business? And try to uncover some of those issues, because whatever keeps a seller up at night about their business is going to keep a buyer up at night to the power of 10. Because a seller has some level of comfort with them, but to an outsider, it's, for a seller, it might be an incident, but to a buyer, it could be catastrophic. So certainly related to the supplier side, there could be issues related to competition, where there's word in the street that so-and-so is going bankrupt, or so-and-so is buying another company, or another company is coming into the area, or there's a company that has a competing product that's taking out more market share, or there's shrinkage in margins because it's becoming tighter as far as cost of the goods are going up, as we've seen in many businesses, yet you can't translate that into a price increase. Now, some of that could become apparent in the financial statements, but not all of it.
Yep. Let's go back to client to concentration to start. And there's other aspects of this too. It's not unusual for a lot of these smaller businesses. It might be big business to the small business, but it might be small business to the big business that they're dealing with. And it's not unusual for some of these things to be relationship driven. So it's entirely a very possible risk that that client could leave because, hey, you know what? Oh, this ownership business is changing. You know, I really like John, was great to me for years. I've stayed with him because I had momentum and I like the guy. Now's the time to look around, right? That sort of thing's not uncommon in a lot of smaller businesses, is it?
It's very common. And there's ways to deal with that. For example, and sometimes a seller is apprehensive about doing it. And so this particular contingency sometimes has to wait until you go further down the road in negotiations or the deal, is oftentimes you have to meet with the clients. Now, a seller is going to be concerned. I don't want you to introduce you to my clients. If word gets out that we're for sale, they're going to stop buying from us, et cetera. So they have their concerns, and they're very often they're legitimate, not always, but there's ways to introduce. For example, I'm bringing in an additional partner, or I'm thinking of opening up another office, or we're looking at taking some time to consider how we expand the business, and we're looking to invest in the business and grow it and want to make sure we can count on your support. Those type of things. Those are the questions. But the key being is you have to get in front of the customer. And so if what I've had in those situations where they've had similar situations, for example, that and employees, key employees that you want to be certain that they're going to stay. And we can potentially touch on that, of course. But sometimes those contingencies may have to wait till later in the deal. So the seller knows that you've signed off on the financials, the other parts have been agreed to, you're okay with that. And that's a later stage contingency that has to be lifted. Another prime example is when clients, we see this in construction, HVAC business, business services, where there may be a bidding process, and not necessarily where a seller is paying off the purchasing agent, but may have a different relationship, a closer relationship. And so they get some favorable bidding status. They let them know you're at 100 grand. These guys came in at 92. You got to sharpen your pencil a little bit. Those type of things.
Yeah. And I think let's go back to the entire customer thing. Not to be the dead horse, but a lot of businesses would be reticent to permit you to speak to their customers, right? Because they don't necessarily want to getting around to their customers or to competitors that you're potentially getting out. That's how much do you encounter that problem?
You encounter it all the time. And unless you have an owner who may be in their late 60s, early 70s, and it's an obvious thing in the eyes of their client world that this individual is going to soon be retiring. Other than that, it is a major concern. And that's to the point we just discussed earlier, that you have to get in front of those clients at the appropriate time. Now, at the same time, you don't want to over-index this. There are times where customer concentration may be 15%, 20% of the business. You have to live with it. You just have to live with it. And you shouldn't be looking at that and saying, oh, that's a deal breaker, because it really isn't. And if you take some, you get some context of what other businesses look like in similar fields, oftentimes that's the norm.
Absolutely. And that's, but it's something that not everybody's going to be comfortable with, unfortunately.
Both sides.
Yep, exactly. All right. So we have that. Let's go back to the key employees. Talk to me about issues surrounding key employees and how important those are.
They can be important, but what I typically find is buyers over-index here. And what I mean by that is really determine who's a key employee. And I don't mean to say anything disparaging about lower level employees, but the individuals that's shipping boxes out of the warehouse or the individual who's doing the actual commercial cleaning in a commercial cleaning business, those are, they're not key employees. They're managers maybe. And so the way you look at it is the question you need to ask yourself is if this person leaves, significantly impact the business? And if yes, how easily can I replace them? The drop downs from that are, if they leave the business and become a competitor, that's one thing. But if they leave and go into another career, that's something else. But if your answer to that question is, hey, yeah, it could impact the business. However, I can replace them. There is other talent there. I'll have a short period of heartburn, but I can bring someone else into play. That person, in my mind, is not necessarily a key employee to the point that saying, I can't get the deal done without them. Now, the other thing that people need to understand is you're selling a business. I come to see you. We identify that Jane is a key employee. She's in charge of the marketing. She drives a lot of the business. We have to keep her on board, or I have to keep her on board. And I say to you, I need an employment contract with Jane because I want to make sure that she's staying on board. And you say, yeah, that's no problem. We'll just include that in the deal, which is a common thing that sellers may throw out. But buyers have to remember, you can't bind Jane. Jane can bind Jane.
Jane can bind Jane.
Jane can bind Jane. And only Jane can bind Jane. And so meeting with Jane is critical. And again, it would be similar to the customer concentration issue where you may have to have that as a later contingency. So you completed the financial review and say, oh, yes, Mr. or Mrs. Seller, the numbers pan out. I'm cool with the valuation and the deal terms that we've agreed to. And now it's time to meet with Jane, or now it's time to meet with the customers.
Okay. Okay. We've talked about a bunch of stuff. So we talked about the employees and the clients. What else should we be looking at when looking to buy a business?
When we talk about some of the things that a seller won't disclose, we could talk about that for a second, is how easy or difficult it is to run. And you see this more often than not in the lower end, where they'll tell you, they'll paint the picture like this is as easy to run as a lemonade stand. And a buyer, it's so important for a buyer to dig into this early on, because where businesses fail or where buyers fail to complete transactions, and the numbers in this industry are dismal, the amount of buyers who never complete a transaction, is because they never align their skill set with the business. And they take a seller's word for it. As crazy as that sounds, because you see it quite frequently, that the business is easy to run. It may be easy to run for the individual who has the right skills to run it, but it's certainly not going to be easy to run for someone who doesn't possess the correct skills, the exact correct skills, not skills, perfectly aligned. And so buyers, they go off the reservation very quickly, because what happens is, and it's one of the 10 commandments that we talk about in our course, which is fall in love with the profit and not the product. And what happens, what I mean by that is, as buyers start to look at this, they start thinking, well, oh, this is a wonderful product and all the wonderful things that I could do with this business and how I can grow with this business. And they start to hallucinate and get delusional about what the future looks like. And they've taken their eye off the ball about the profit piece, the P piece. That's critically important. And am I the right individual to keep driving the revenues and profits of that business? Because when you start to fall in love with the product, you end up becoming reckless with all the other deal points that you need to address.
As I often tell people when it comes to negotiating, the first thing they got to come to terms with is that you have to walk in everything ready to walk away. Otherwise, you will make foolish decisions, again, falling in love with the product or the business or whatever else it is. And that could lead you down the path to destruction, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. And what happens is when you start to fall in love with it, you start to see what the business can do, and you mentally start counting your money of all the things, these wonderful initiatives. And very often, it's easy to start looking at a business saying, okay, this business has been on cruise control for a while. The seller hasn't put in new initiatives. I'm going to do this and this, but you have no clue, because at that point, you're a dumb shit, pardon my French. You have no idea what you're doing. So you don't know if any of those initiatives work. The seller may have tried them. And the reality is, how do you even know if those make sense until you have the guts of the business in your belly? And so being able to walk, one of the disciplines that people need to have, to your point, which is so spot on, is you never allow yourself to start making dumb decisions or any decisions strictly because of the amount of time you've put into the deal. So you have these combination of emotion and logic throughout the process. The seller starts off emotionally, the buyer starts off logically. The buyer's looking at this from a financial standpoint, bettering my life standpoint, those type of things. The seller looks at this from emotionally, and here's how much money I'm going to get into my pocket. And then what happens, once those lines start to blur and the seller becomes logical and the buyer becomes emotional, buyer gets in trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So we covered that stuff. What else we got? Because we got 10. I think we've covered a good five or six thus far. Where are we?
I think when we talk about terms is very important. Where a seller, the first thing is, we want all cash. Yeah, you and everybody else.
Everybody wants cash. Yes.
Everybody wants cash.
I want top dollar and
no risk. Yeah, right. I want all cash. And it's one of those, I'll tell you what's not happening, that.
Yeah.
Buyers need.
Well, no, it can.
It can, yeah, with a big discount.
Very low price.
With a big discount. And exactly that. And so buyers going into this should understand something. And I hear this quite frequently, and I did this boot camp for a group of cohorts or individuals that are being sponsored to acquire businesses. And I did about 9 hours of education with them. And we got into the discussion about win. And my take on win in these transactions, win sounds fantastic, but it's completely delusional as it relates to these transactions, because the buyer assumes the greatest part of the risk in these deals. And so the philosophy has to be, buyer wins, seller is reasonably happy. And so when it comes to the deal terms, they'll tell you what they're thinking of, and deal terms have to be worked. And there's a beautiful, the easiest way to work deal terms to understand what's true or what the seller is willing to accept is putting in an offer. And that's when you can find the seller hot buttons, whether it be the down payment, whether it be the continuation of the business, whether it be how much you're thinking about investing in the business, whether or not they're carrying a note, what size note they're going to be carrying. And buyers need to start getting very comfortable with making offers. And this is even more applicable in the lower market. I'm starting to see a lot more of it now in the higher end or institutional, is you got to get comfortable with making offers. You can't keep dancing. At some point, you got to start buying furniture and rent an apartment together. And so putting in an offer is really the only way that you can find out and get great clarity on what are the seller's hot buttons related to the deal terms.
Yeah, and it's not just price. We start getting to things like escrow amounts or basically like financing terms or liability clauses, like basically indemnity. Those types of things, everybody wants a nice cash and walk and no obligation deal at the maximum price available. Either you're finding the world's biggest idiot to buy your business that way, and usually there's a lack of correlation between people who basically are buying businesses and the world's biggest idiots, and or you're basically going to have to acquiesce on those terms.
You're going to have to acquiesce. And the reality is sometimes it just takes a little bit of pain and time. In other words, to be able to walk from a deal so a seller can understand that no one's beating down a path to the door to buy their business at the price and terms that they think it is, that it's worth. And so the points that you raise related to all these other components to the deal, whether it relate to purchase price allocation, reps and warranties, liability, escrow, et cetera, those are all negotiated. You can deal with all of those. Sometimes they get a little contentious. And so you got to deal those one by one. What the seller thinks, oftentimes they need to speak to their advisor, what deals look like. But most importantly, often a buyer needs to just take a step back and say, you know what, here's what I'm prepared to pay. And that's the end of it. And have the discipline to let the seller, especially when you know what you're doing, you understand what the market's going to bear, because the market dictates these things to a large extent. And your point about the correlation between who's walking in with a lot of cash and idiots is very appropriate, because the very sharp people are the ones with a lot of cash, not the idiots typically. And making sure that people understand that the deal terms go far beyond what is the purchase price? What are the deal terms as far as cash down, any seller note, et cetera? There's a lot of them. Some of them are outside the scope of the buyer and their accountant or attorney take over, but certainly are all things that you have to get into. Each one, there's a buyer's perspective, a seller's perspective, and you've got to negotiate in good terms. And I found when you can establish a meaningful relationship with the seller, and that the buyer and seller start to entrust each other, and the buyer wants to buy and the seller wants to sell, you can't stop them from getting a deal done.
Agreed. And it's interesting because sometimes the entire them accepting it, I think of two lines I've used in the past, or the two things I've seen in the past. One, when someone was like, I just want to sell for the maximum price for cash and walk away from this thing. It's like, great. So you're selling for the minimum price for cash and walking away from this thing. I rephrase the entire thing. You basically get to understand that. And the second one always comes down to sometimes the walking away thing, that might be a slow process for them to finally wake up to the fact that they're delusional about the thing. I think about one case I saw where valuation was done. The only response was, I think it's worth this, which was like 35% more than what they said. And the valuator's like, I'm sorry, but I don't see how. He's like, and is there something you haven't told us? No, I just think it's worth that much more. It's okay. And sure enough, we can't market your business at that price because no one's going to buy it, but good luck to you. And effectively, finally, the guy ended up selling the business 4 years later for a price far closer to reality. And unfortunately, sometimes it may take a long time where they basically just get to the point of, I guess I'm not going to get that after all. But it's everybody thinks their baby's beautiful. And unfortunately, not every baby is pretty.
Not every baby is. And the key point here is the description of price. So you had some great things where you tell people the examples of it is what happens by and large is what a seller thinks their business is worth has nothing to do with the value. And there's a big difference between worth and value because they've put blood, sweat, and tears into this. They have an emotional attachment. Very often they say, here's what I need to retire, or here's what I've put into the business. So I've got to get that out at least. And that's not relative to the value. That's relative to the worth in the eyes of the seller. It has nothing to do with the value of the business in the real world. And sometimes it takes time for you to take a step back and let the seller start breathing oxygen from this planet. I find what's very helpful is don't be afraid to, when a broker need intermediary says that standard line of, we have other offers. And I'm not saying anything disparaging. I do that's intermediary fine. Work. And when they say they have other offers, my answer is always, exactly. That's fine. Go work those offers. If for any reason they don't work out, come back. We'll continue the discussion.
Yeah.
And it's all of a sudden you get one. It's not really, it's not exactly an offer. It's an indication of interest. The other one, don't be so hasty. We can take in competitive offers. We're accepting backups. So you'll see the backpedaling pretty quickly. The key thing being is don't be afraid to stand firm. It's also very important that buyers need to be able to defend their valuation. You can't just pick numbers out of the air the same way the seller has. And so being able to put together a robust valuation is really important so you're able to defend it.
Absolutely. And it's funny. So even personal experience, sometimes there is a quote unquote big idiot out there. I remember one case where I was offered a part of someone's business and did all my due diligence, whatever else it was. They decided they wanted to sell to me, but there was another bidder. And basically he's like, yeah, so they matched my price. I'm like, well, that's good for them. I can't do it. And I really want you to get this instead. Be competitive. Make me an offer. I'm like, if you're telling me the truth,
I did.
If you're telling me the truth that they basically met your price, I'm telling you, I'm not going to insult you to your face by giving you something that makes no sense in comparison, because the price I would have to give you makes no sense in comparison. So sometimes there are people who will buy for ridiculously stupid valuations. Now, I will say that ended up being I know what happened after the fact, and ended up being a suboptimal experience for the clients who got purchased. And then that also led to a resale of part of that business pretty quickly thereafter. So I feel pretty validated in that situation. But nevertheless, sometimes that can happen. But oftentimes there just isn't, right? There just really isn't. So,
exactly. So
frankly, again, this comes back to the first step. The first step is not feeling the need to make a deal, right?
Right. You have to be prepared to walk. And in some cases, you have to be prepared to run as you find out some of the things that are inherent with the business. But yes, you've got to be disciplined. You've got to be in approach. But I think it's important at the same time for when we're discussing this topic is while we said you want to be logical, you've got to be disciplined, et cetera. At the same time, you can't be nuts, meaning you have to be prepared to pay a premium or bump up your price a little bit when the business makes sense. You can't get so locked into saying, I'm not paying a penny over this, when all of the other pieces of the business make sense. In other words, it's the right business for you. There are growth opportunities from your expertise that you can take this business, run it effectively. It's going to provide you with the income and the return that you're looking for. You're going to be able to improve the lives of others. You recognize, because businesses are sold at a multiple, that every dollar of value that you add to the business, you're going to get a multiple of that when the time comes to exit. And so when all of the benefits, even though this is a little bit more philosophical or emotional, but when all of those benefits line up and they make sense, you have to be prepared to bump up your price a little bit because it's too crazy to walk. And good businesses are hard to find. And sometimes people get so locked into evaluation. It's where you see in the negotiation where people draw a line in the sand. And it's just a dumb negotiating tactic, unless it's something that's so critical. You don't want to be drawing lines in the sand. It's okay to address red flags, but that deal breaker line in the sand mentality, too hard-ass, it rarely works.
Plus, the thing is, how many small business deals, especially in this segment of the market we're talking about, how many of them are like essentially vitally critical to the buyer? Are the buyer is going to basically tie up something so big that like effectively, you know, that the upside of that purchase is so big that it would be, I need to pay a massive price and premium to do it. More often than not, all you got to do is insult the person. You don't like, there really is very little leverage that can be exercised by the buyer other than saying no.
You say no. And there's also the point of by the seller. And the other point is buyers shouldn't be afraid to insult sellers.
Yeah. No, I think there's I'd say to a point, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like you don't want to be nuts. And right.
Whereas right. I remember a negotiation where someone was like, if you don't ask, you don't get. I said, stop right there.
Yeah, absolutely
if
wrong.
You insult, then what you're going to get in return is something you weren't bargaining for.
Yeah, so, backhander.
Being respectful with your ask.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole thing is when you go into these negotiations, and when I talk about insulting the seller, when they have an inflated price or you've done your valuation, you've done it in a good way, and there's a big gap between that, there's no problem with insulting the seller, but certainly it's not your tactic going in because you want to pay her a fair price and get a valuable business. And when you talk about the negotiations, you've got to be reasonable. You got to be fair. You don't have to give something every time you get something. The same way it's not a battle. You don't have to win every single point. Sometimes you just have to agree and move on. And you don't want to be a hard ass. What I have seen over and over again, and I've been doing this for 34 years, thousands of transactions, is you want to be able to establish a thoughtful, meaningful discourse with the seller and have a good relationship. And you don't have to dive right into the key points right from the beginning. If you can establish a nice, comfortable relationship where you can have a good back and forth with the seller, you can get things resolved. This is not a war. And this is not a battle. Like mentioned earlier, you don't need to win every point. You address them. Some points are more difficult to resolve than others. Sometimes sellers get insulted. You have to make sure that it's done in a good way, that it's not, you know, necessarily meant that way. But at the same time, there are times that a seller gets insulted. And that's as long as your insult is based on quantifiable valuation, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. It happens. And so you just don't want to be, someone's asking $5 million for business, you pick some number out of your rear end that it's worth two and you throw them and you wonder why they're insulted and you've put no detail into your offer. Of course, they're going to be insulted and they deserve at that point and it's disrespectful. And so you know what, you're better off, go find something else, go find another. If you want to be a bottom feeder, that's what you're going to get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we're on to that. What else do we need to talk about that they're not telling you? I spent a lot this one because there's like at least 10 points. So we're going
to. At least 10 points. We talked about easy to run, certainly related to the valuation. We talked about the price and terms. I think the supplier issues are really important and how they get their material. When I talk about suppliers, I talk about the whole world of suppliers, meaning it could be raw materials. It could be a supplier who's their landlord. And so it could be a lease that's expiring. There could be, you see this more in retail, for example, where there's typically road construction happens every 10 years. And they don't disclose to you that they got a notice from the shopkeepers association that they're planning to do some road work in the near future. And that could be typically impacts. It doesn't impact destination locations as much because people find a way around the detour. But if in retail, that's a significant thing. It's the, for example, another one where they know that the landlord's not intending to extend the lease and the lease expires in a couple of years, even though they may have an option. And that's one of the things that a buyer has to, if it's a property or a business rather, where the business relies on its location, whether that be retail is more appropriate, but there's also things like lawn and garden centers, right? You can't move a lawn and garden center. Yeah. Okay. So in those type of cases, also for convenience, even though it's a ordinary business offering business services, an HVAC company, there could be a proximity to the client base that's also a proximity to the staff and the technicians that everybody's got a 20-minute drive. And all of a sudden, if you have to go relocate, it is possible. And even if you have to relocate in the same area, your rents may go up. And so that type of consideration with a seller won't disclose to you are really important. And that, again, so much of this is incumbent on the buyer, because I think the first thing you talked about from the beginning, which we went back and forth about, is what are they required to disclose? How much are they willing to disclose? And buyers need to understand that outside of the legal requirements and material issues, they're not required to disclose anything. And so it's incumbent upon the buyer to uncover them.
Yeah. Like the lease things, like someone who's doing good diligence is going to verify that the lease can be signed over to the, because a lot of times those leases will basically have some sort of approval mechanism whereby the buyer has to basically be approved. So that does matter.
Oh, it does matter. It's really important. And buyers need to understand it's not like someone, the seller is necessarily being cagey or fraudulent. They don't have to. If you don't ask, they don't have to tell.
Yeah. Or they may not, it's just not top of mind. They signed the lease 10 years ago. The thing renewed once. They didn't look at it twice. And that's that.
They don't even think about it. It's one of those things. It's not keeping them up at night. So, yeah.
Which is another reason why you're not going to get the top dollar, because at the end of the day, these are the unknowns. And those unknowns are never 100% disclosed. So
they're never 100% disclosed. And they don't necessarily have to do them. So that's, again, it keeps coming back to the point that the buyer needs to be prepared. They need to be knowledgeable. They need to understand the process. They need to go through this in a methodical way to be able to uncover all of these potential problems. Totally. And problems. And the other thing is, what may be a problem to a buyer is, we touched upon it earlier, it may not be a problem in the eyes of a seller. One of our reports in secret number 10 is, what's lurking in the shadows? What is there an issue that could come up that you don't know about? The seller typically may not even know about it. For example, there was the history of this is pretty interesting because it's changed over the years, which was related to, I live in South Florida, and I was looking at a company a number of years ago that did concrete inspections. Mm-hmm. It used to be every 40 years that you had to go in the condos and any type of commercial building had to evaluate the condition of the concrete surrounding the building, seawalls, mm-hmm. et cetera, foundations, et cetera. And it was a 40-year thing. I love the business because when you do concrete inspection, for example, of a seawall, the only way you can investigate the concrete is you have to bash the concrete. You have to put a couple of big ass holes right in the concrete at various places to check the rebar, et cetera. And now let's say everything is wonderful, then you have to fix the wall. And so it's a beautiful business because you can go and do the damage and you have to, and then you can repair it. It would be like people that are looting stores and they also are in the commercial window business, right? They're smashing the windows and grabbing stuff and then they have to call them to fix the windows.
Great business. Create your own demand. I love it.
Create your own demand. And it was really interesting. And there was at one point where even though it was a 40-year requirement, at one point they were talking about a 50-year requirement. And the seller didn't even know about it. And it was being talked about. As it turned, if to do investigation related, there was a lot of research at that point to find that out and said, okay, that changes the dynamic. However, as it turned out, unfortunately, because of that horrible condo collapse in Surfside, I think it was 100 plus people, that has been changed. And I think it's down to 20 years plus a whole lot of other conditions and criteria for anything in proximity to the ocean because of the wear and tear of the salt water. But there was another point related to that particular business that really was was a looming threat, but it ties into the competition. Was this company, it wasn't a big company. It was doing, I think it was $2.4 million and they had four, but it was highly profitable and the demand didn't stop because they kept working their way up and down the coast. And I looked at this and said, there's a couple other small players. I looked at this as a roll-up. It was actually a business that I was looking to buy. And the seller had four crews. They were doing $2.4 million. We started talking about the competition. And he said, yeah, there's one other minor player in the area. That was it. And I said, how much business that they do? He said, it's pretty much the same. I know them for years. And that was the end of it. So if you're not, you have to be a little skeptical and you have to be a little creative and you look at that. And so I said, you know what? So I'm making the assumption now that you have, and this is internal thought, you've got four crews, you're doing $2.4 million. I'm making the assumption that each crew does about is responsible for generating around $600,000 in revenue. In other words, they can handle $600,000 in revenue. Four crews, $2.4 million, the math, $600,000. So I'm thinking I'm going to go to the competitor, which wasn't too far away. And it's an early morning business. Like people are on the road like 6 o'clock in the morning because you got to get out to the locations pretty early. And I'm thinking they probably have 3, 4, 5 crews that are coming out. Then I figure, okay, so if they have five, they're going to do $3 million a year. Like 20 crews came out of there. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, this is an $8 million business. And right nearby, and there's only, you always want to hire local companies to do the work, and there was really nobody else. They could gobble up your business in a hurry because they know who the customers are. Everybody knows who the customers are. So you're telling me this, they're not much of a competitor? They're four times the size of you. And if you don't do the investigation, if you're not curious, if you don't think about this from a different way, and very much you want to process and take note of everything the seller tells you, And there's a bunch of critical questions that you have to ask. You want to take note of all of that, but you've got to validate, verify, and investigate.
Absolutely true. It doesn't help the fact that most financials aren't even audited. That's another
most problem. Most aren't. Yeah,
most aren't. But yeah, there's a lot of the unknown unknowns. Always, I think the issue is coming down to basically creating a situation for yourself whereby the number of unknown unknowns are minimal, right? But you want to make them at least known unknowns that you can investigate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because most of them you can solve for. You want to deal with there's little issues that are important. But going into this philosophically, that's a very important approach when you look at this, and especially during the due diligence, you don't want to treat any incidents as catastrophes, and you don't want to treat any catastrophes as incidents. You just want to keep a calm and understand buyers. One of the three biggest mistakes that buyers make is they're looking for a perfect business. It doesn't exist. I used to work with a guy whose name was Jerry Efros. He was a much older gentleman. He was a tail gunner in World War II. And he used to tell people, you want to buy a perfect business, buy a toll booth. Other than that, they don't exist. Every business has blemishes. Every business has warts. It's what can you solve for? There's always going to be some incidents. You've got to learn to live with some of the things because they're not really that important in the grand scheme of things of all of a sudden becoming a business owner. You just have to compartmentalize some of them and recognize that as an entrepreneur, there's always going to be pivots. There's always going to be some roadblocks thrown up in your way. You have to navigate your way over them, under them, or around them, and not to get hung up on everything being perfect. You look at all these things and say, can I make it perfect? But when I take over, and that's great, but it shouldn't be preventing you from making the acquisition as long as those items are incidental, because it's nothing's perfect.
Excellent. So before we wrap up, any kind of last words of advice to potential buyers?
For potential buyers, going through the laundry list of things where they make a mistake is they definitely want to ramp up their knowledge and be comfortable with the process. That's critically important because you have to learn as much about this as possible. Most buyers are first-time buyers, and there's no other purchase that you've made in your lifetime that remotely resembles the purchase of a business. People's first inclination is related to real estate. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is hundreds of moving parts potentially, and so you're ramping up your knowledge is critically important. The second piece would be making sure that you get really well in tune with what type of business is right for you. Because whatever it is that you do best has to be the single most important driving factor of the revenue and profits of any business you consider purchasing. And sometimes that's a little bit of a scavenger hunt to get to that point, because most people, what they think they're good at is usually not what necessarily what they're good at. And oftentimes what they think, what they like is not necessarily what they're good at. And then they confuse experience with expertise. Just because you worked in a certain industry doesn't make you an expert there. It's what you did specifically. What is your greatest skill set? And the third one we talked about, which is understanding there's no perfect business. So if you can get yourself educated, work towards coming up with what is the business I was, you know, born to own from a skill set perspective, that is going to set you on the right path and distinguish you from all the people who never get to the finish line, because this is not a difficult process, it's complex. And so there's lots of moving parts. Yes, you have to do this in a methodical way, step by step, and keep at it, because there's some difficult times and deals are lost and deals are fall apart in due diligence. So you just dust yourself off and keep going. That's the life of an entrepreneur.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Thank you so much. Where can people find you?
Pretty easy. RichardParker.com. We've got lots of free articles, reports that we talked about, our main course that we've been sold over 100,000 copies of those. Everything's available on RichardParker.com. And if anybody has any questions, just use the contact us page, get in hold of me. I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
So that was this week's episode of Financial Planning for Canadian Business Owners. As these are sporadic, I hope to start them up a little bit more regularly in the next little while. But until then, I will catch you next time.
This podcast was brought to you by Woodgate Financial, an award-winning financial planning firm catering to high net worth individuals, business owners, and their families. To learn more, go to woodgate.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or find more episodes at jasonpereira.ca. You can even ask Siri, Alexa, or Google Home to subscribe for you.